Greetings, Sun Sounds listeners, and welcome to the Philosopher Program. This is your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis, along with her co-host, Bullet Cat Lewis. We begin our program with some daily selections from Science of Mind, a guide for spiritual living. And the theme this month is On the Wings of Love. And the daily selections have all been about self-love. Compassion for myself. Self-compassion is simply treating yourself with the same kindness, care, and concern you show a good friend. Christopher Germer. We can have no understanding of divine compassion unless we ourselves first exercise compassion. Ernest Holmes, Help for Today, page 54.3. Self-compassion is a building block of self-love. To have it means that we speak kindly to ourselves. It means we love and honor ourselves even when we make a mistake. It means we give ourselves the benefit of the doubt. All these things often are so much easier for us to do for others. We might go out of our way to have and express compassionate understanding for and about other people. Sometimes we go to great lengths to guide ourselves to a place of great compassion for other people. I am blessed to have a few young children in my life. Recently, I noticed how I go out of my way to show them compassion. I want them to feel loved always, and I will stay present so I can be sure they experience an adult who treats them with compassion and understanding. It dawned on me that all of these gestures of compassion would be great to give myself if I just could do the same things for myself. If I could just talk to myself as if I were a child that I cherished, that might allow me to experience my own compassionate heart I so easily want to give to others. When I do this, I hear my compassionate inner voice urging me to feel the softness of my journey. Affirmation. Today, I speak to and think of myself with kindness and compassion. Self-worth is self-love. You are worthy of love and belonging. You are worthy of joy. You are worthy of happiness. Brené Brown. The road to self-discovery often calls for a clearing away of the underbrush of ignorance, fear, superstition, and a sense of isolation that made us feel we are unworthy, unheld, and lost. Ernest Holmes, A Holmes Reader on Meaning, page 35.1. We have to know and confront our stories of self-worth if they are negative in any way. When we have a sense of worthlessness at our core, the law acts on this self-awareness. We get and experience exactly what we think we deserve. The law of mind responds by corresponding. When we find ourselves experiencing things and conditions that are not born out of abundance, joy, or love, we likely are experiencing some patterns of unworthiness operating within our consciousness. This means we must be willing to challenge those patterns and let them go. Have you noticed that I keep saying that? For some of us, even taking these 31 days to repeat these instructions over and over and doing them for 31 days straight will just be a start in finding and addressing those patterns. We have habitually made agreements with unworthiness for so long that we feel like they are comfortable patterns. They're like a well-worn soft shirt that may be torn up and may smell a little rank. Yet it is familiar, and we sometimes prefer what is familiar over what might genuinely serve us. Giving up this familiar way of being can feel confronting and challenging. At some point, we can see that arguing for our unworthiness just keeps us stuck in living small and unhappy lives. We must argue for our worth. We must shift our awareness to a perspective that embraces the deep truth that we are worthy of all good simply because we exist. Affirmation. I recognize and embrace my inherent worthiness. And from the Daily Word published by Unity, grow. I grow and prosper with each positive thought. Just as a gardener plants tender seedlings in rich soil, I plant thought seeds in the garden of my mind. Meditating on those thoughts encourages those seeds to grow in my consciousness. I have faith my consistently positive thoughts will help produce good outcomes. Throughout my life, I have nurtured my growth in this way. I had dreams I turned into goals, which I turned into action. I relied on my faith and other spiritual gifts to feel the presence of God, of spirit of the universe, as I grew. This connection helped me be brave when I worried whether I would succeed or if I felt discouraged and ready to give up. With every positive thought I planted, I sowed the seeds of my eventual blessings. I am so grateful for my growth. Resilient. Courageous and strong, I am resilient. Everyone who gets knocked down from time to time, has the choice whether to give up or get up. Getting up and gathering the strength and desire to try again is resilience. Spiritual living helps me build it. Claiming divine ideas in prayer, engaging the power of my imagination to envision my success, and using my wisdom and will to discern the best way forward and choose it all help me be resilient in the face of defeat or discouragement. Through the power of the Christ within, I am willing to keep trying until I succeed. I understand setbacks happen to everyone. I do not let them deter me or take a failed effort personally. I am strong and capable of doing what I set my mind to. I am resilient. And from Mark Nepos, The Book of Awakening, Having the Life You Want by Being Present to the Life You Have, The Chick Being Born. Every crack is also an opening. When in the midst of great change, it is helpful to remember how a chick is born. From the view of the chick, it is a terrifying struggle. Confined and curled in a dark shell, half-formed, the chick eats all its food and stretches to the contours of its shell. It begins to feel hungry and cramped. Eventually, the chick begins to starve and feels suffocated by the ever-shrinking space of its world. Finally, its own growth begins to crack the shell, and the world, as the chick knows it, is coming to an end. Its sky is falling. As the chick struggles and wiggles through the cracks, it begins to eat its shell. In that moment, growing but fragile, starving and cramped, its world breaking, the chick must feel like it is dying. Yet once everything it has relied on falls away, the chick is born. It doesn't die, but falls into the world. The lesson is profound. Transformation always involves the falling away of things we have relied on, and we are left with the feeling that the world as we know it is coming to an end, because it is. Yet the chick offers us the wisdom that the way to be born, while still alive, is to eat our own shell. When faced with great change, in self, in relationship, in our sense of calling, we somehow must take in all that has enclosed us, nurtured us, incubated us, so when the new life is upon us, the old is within us. The next chance you get, watch something being born. If moved by this notion, actively pursue this. Go to a zoo or a farm or a nursery or an aquarium or walk the floor of newborns at your local hospital. As you witness birth of some kind, note what detail touches you. Take it as a teacher and see if it describes something struggling to be born in you. We return to Science of Mind for Reverend Dr. Andriette Earle's monthly column from The Inside Out, Igniting Mental Conviction. The truth is that every day offers opportunities to allow some light to shine through the cracks of the wall called our belief system into the unexplored rooms where our spiritual nature dwells, waiting patiently for us to enter and be more of who we have come here to be. Dennis Merritt Jones. Recently, I supported a dear friend during a serious health challenge. My friend was tremendously well-versed in the ramifications of her diagnosis and prognosis. So when I visited her in the hospital, she knew all too well that her condition was potentially life-threatening. Because she is also a student of Science of Mind, she was thoroughly receptive to spiritual mind treatment and to choosing a more desirable alternative to her current medical prognosis. As religious scientists, we are blessed to know that the power of mind, when fully engaged, is a magnet that draws us toward our good while pulling our good to us. This is how we create our lives. It is done unto us as we believe. The power of prayer, especially spoken as spiritual mind treatment, engages and enlivens the power of mind. What began as my suggestion that my friend use her extensive knowledge of the human body to help her envision perfect circulation, perfect assimilation, and perfect elimination became a spontaneous prayer treatment in the emergency intensive care unit. As I began speaking from a place of what I know for sure about divine love expressing as her health, I realized I was also announcing the goodness of God, of spirit, of the universe. I began praying in earnest. With conviction, I declared her ever-present wellness and the divine flow of health and vitality within her whole, perfect, and complete body. The abiding principle of health and wellness is not restricted by medical history, diagnosis, prognosis, or precedent, and knowledge of this truth aided in surrendering doubt and uncertainty. Although I do not recall the specific words I spoke, I know they ignited the power of mind, accessed the field of infinite possibility, and put my friend and me on notice that we were fully empowered to envision and claim a vibrant, healthy alternative. And claim we did. I give thanks that all is well. And from the same issue, an article by Margaret Stortz, Owning Our Divine Nature. Every time we think, we are setting divine wisdom in action for our purposes, whether we know it or not. Since our thoughts have power, we had better know what backs them up and take responsibility for them. I consider awareness of our oneness with God, Spirit, the universe, and awareness of our divine nature an absolute salvation from helpless, hopeless, ignorant living. With this knowledge, we can extricate ourselves from circumstances without light or freedom and create magnificent lives built on infinite inspiration. However, such awareness of our infinite nature is both wonderful and terrifying, because now that we know who we are responsible for the power at our disposal. We are anything but innocent animals, dependent on instincts and simple learning to get by. We have the wisdom of the infinite to uplift and guide us. I'm not sure we think of this as a responsibility, but it is, of course, just as paying attention to the right use of fire and electricity is. Our divine nature gives us tremendous power, since the mind we use is the divine mind. We may not have the expanse of allness of infinity at our disposal, but we have as much of the love and wisdom of God, of Spirit, of the universe, as we can encompass and use. In fact, every time we think, we set divine wisdom in action for our purposes, whether we know this or not. Since we are learning of the power of our thoughts, we had better know what backs them up as well. Not for nothing did Ernest Holmes refer to thoughts as things, because he believed that definite states of consciousness, as they become subjective, operate through a creative field and tend to reproduce themselves in form. In other words, our thoughts do not stay airy ideas that blow away. Strongly held ideas tend to make themselves known in some ways in our very lives, either through forms or actions. It seems that we are far more creative than we know, and that we are always creating something, whether we plan to or not, which makes it necessary that we do indeed mind our minds. The website, mindbodygreen.com, says simply, "What you put your attention on grows." Holmes often reminds us that we can choose what we think about, and that we can change our minds at any time. He writes, "Let us choose to identify ourselves with abundance and success." Taking responsibility for our thoughts and actions. Holmes is right. We can choose what we think about. In fact, we always are, either with care or without much attention. The old aphorism, "To whom much is given, much is expected," does indeed apply here. We will use superior knowledge always, and it is our responsibility to use it correctly. This is a principle of elevated human behavior. We do not come into life knowing that we must take care of how we think. Either we are taught this behavior or we will stumble around, confounding ourselves until we figure it out, if we will make the effort to do so. Self-responsibility is not an easy lesson because it means we must stand behind our choices and actions rather than blame others. Actually, because self-responsibility is so hard to act on or sometimes even recognize, humanity has discovered the need to create and agree upon bodies of civil laws. Because often we will not restrain our actions or redirect our thinking, we will require the laws of the land to constrain our behaviors. Now, if we know that we share the nature of God, of Spirit, of the universe, if we are conscious of what this means, our ways of thinking of ourselves and our relationships to life should set us free from destructive thoughts and feelings. I recently came across an article in the San Francisco Chronicle that made a distinction between thinking from a strictly technical point of view and thinking from the perspective of the study of the humanities. The piece suggested that technical thinking could be pretty selfish, even post-human, while thoughts infused with literature and the social sciences made it easier to consider other people's feelings, a more high-minded skill. I have to ask, can it be this easy to remember or forget who we are as spiritual beings? our responsibility to others. If we are careless in our behaviors with ourselves, it almost naturally follows that we will behave toward others in the same way, for our brothers and sisters in life can be as close as our own heartbeats. And such thoughts and acts can easily become habitual, far from what would be a part of our divine nature. President Bill Clinton gave a speech at a peace accord between Israel and the Palestinians on September 13, 1993, and reminded the audience that there were always those who preferred the easy habits of hatred to the hard labors of reconciliation. He reminded the listeners that right regard for others, especially those who seemed different, takes great intention and consistent effort. Unfortunately, some of us still practice these negative behaviors toward others, often toward those who do not obviously seem the same as ourselves. If we would not consider driving our cars on the sidewalks out of concern for the well-being of others, how can we then write them off as unworthy of our highest regard? In a belief in oneness with God, we naturally regard others as part of that oneness. And if we act as if we do not, this can only mean that we do not truly believe in divine unity or our divine nature. If we find that we are casually slipping into negative habits, we may wish to engage in some more spiritual studies and practices to bring us back to what we really believe. Oneness with God extends to all. The world of conditions and affairs can seldom help us maintain a belief in the oneness of all life. It can be replete with images and actions that seem to make our belief in oneness a kind of lie. Sometimes religious people belittle others to make their own beliefs paramount. And when some believe that their spiritual system is the only true one, it makes shared unity harder to find. In fact, if we criticize others in a harsh way, we've actually forgotten that oneness extends to all. People we love and people we may not like at all, and we have forgotten our own oneness yet again. Thinking in terms of our divine nature can be quite challenging. We are so often caught up in our own human affairs that we hardly remember the infinite overtones that hold us. This is why quiet time, reading, and prayer work become such important practices. It may be true that inwardly we know that we are one with life and the things of life, but we must often work to remind ourselves of this overarching truth. This is one reason I say that we must own our divine nature, which is an integral part of how we think of ourselves as divine. These are not just convenient titles that we give ourselves to make us feel spiritual. They are working aspects of our own being. We say we have the nature of God, of spirit, of the universe, that the mind we use whenever we think is an extension of the activities of the infinite. Therefore, we must be mindful of ourselves as using the God energies every time we act. If we think of ourselves as part of the infinite, we must consider that everyone and everything else in existence as part of the infinite as well, and we may not all know this. It is true, then, that when we go forth into the world, we will be meeting with others sharing the nature of God, Spirit, the universe, everywhere we go, whether they appear to be exactly like us or different in every way. Let's allow Holmes to have the last word. The answer to every question is within everyone, because everyone is within Spirit, and Spirit is an indivisible whole. And from the same issue, Carol Burbank's monthly column, Spirituality and Leadership. Spark joy with spiritual leadership. In uncertain times, laughter is a leadership gift. Are you giving it to yourself? Are you sharing it in celebration with the people who depend on you? Pastor John Pavlovitz calls the crisis of our times cruelty sickness and recommends kindness, active engagement in justice and community building as steps towards spiritual and social health. I'd like to add a practice of communal joy to that list. Does your sense of humor swing to irony, satire, slapstick, or clever wit? Whatever your preference, your unique spiritual joy can energize you and your followers with fierce, life-sustaining delight as you take a stand for your values and principles. Ernest Holmes advised us to have the will to be well, to be happy, and to live in joy. Spiritual leaders open our hearts to happiness, affirming connection and expansion, when cultish leaders teach us fear and isolation. Our ability to embrace joy brings a gleam of hope, moving us forward together. Let's bring music and celebration into our work, letting laughter elevate us into the oneness that affirms us all. It's as close as you can get to a hug without touching, according to Gina Barreca. Wherever you find yourself leading, spark joy with the soul-fueling hug of shared laughter. Satirist Malcolm Muggeridge quipped, "Only dead fish swim with the stream." Laughter helps us swim upstream and find fertile pools in any current. When we laugh together, we remember we are not alone. When we laugh at ourselves, we gain perspective that leads us to God, to spirit, to the universe. Sharing spiritual joy is a special kind of leadership. Imagine a flow of energy moving beneath and above and through us, always mirroring the ideas and energies we add. Imagine the bubbling clarity of a guffaw, unclogging the fear and anxieties that muddy that energy, collectively and individually. Imagine the space of love and possibility that opens up effortlessly in the giggling, rollicking, revolutionary prayer of spiritual laughter. When creating a world that works for everyone, let laughter lead the way home. And from the July-August issue of Spirituality and Health, a Unity publication, we turn to Kevin Anderson's monthly column, The Soul of Therapy. Let God be God in you. Have you ever heard of Ulrich Tolle? Probably not, because before becoming a well-known spiritual teacher, he changed his first name to Eckhart. In a dream, he saw several books he knew he'd authored with Eckhart Tolle on the cover. Reflecting on the dream, he realized he considered the teachings of 13th-century monk Meister Eckhart to be wonderful and deep, so he chose Eckhart for his new spiritual name. Few people think of God the way Meister Eckhart talked about God 700 years ago. I ask most of my patients whether they have a faith, spirituality, or meaning system. Nearly everyone responds by telling me whether they believe in God or go to church. Most talk about God as a being they should pray to more or with whom they should have a better relationship. Many use language that implies God lives somewhere removed from the physical world. For Meister Eckhart, God is an ever-present energy that wants to flow into and through us, but is blocked because we are too full of ourselves. I ask patients about their spirituality in part because research over the past 30 years has revealed that our ideas of God, religion, or spirituality can have either positive or negative effects on mental health. I want to understand how patients draw on spirituality to cope with challenging times and how spiritual or religious ideas may be blocking their healing. The heart of Meister Eckhart's spirituality is captured in these lines. God desires urgently that you get out of his way. Ah, beloved people, why don't you let God be God in you? A master of simple and effective images, he said we are like an empty wine bottle with a cork in it. We can't fill up with God because we're blocking God out. The cork is our worries, doubts, fears, anger, comparisons, woundedness, money fixation, cravings, workaholism, habits, addictions, bitterness, or judgments. Even our mistaken and limiting ideas of God, Meister Eckhart taught, can be part of the cork keeping divine energies from flowing into us. Sometimes, when people talk in therapy about their ideas of God, I ask them to walk with me into the office kitchen to see a wonderful piece of technology. "Look at this. It's amazing," I say, as I open the faucet. When I move this handle, the water comes out instantly, and when I move it back, the flow stops. We don't have to pray to the water, beg it to help us, or believe in it. It's always there, waiting to flow as soon as it is unblocked. Most of us have been so conditioned to think of God as being outside ourselves that I find it more useful to imagine God as all the higher energies that flow in us as soon as they are unblocked. Love, compassion, acceptance, forgiveness, kindness, peace, mindfulness, courage, and creativity. Meister Eckhart wanted people to focus less on dogmatic beliefs about God and more on living with divine energies. One of my favorite lines of his makes this clear. "You may call God love, you may call God goodness, but the best name for God is compassion." During cold snaps in the Midwest, we sometimes let our faucets trickle to prevent pipes from freezing. It's easy to live this way much of the time, not completely blocking divine energies, but allowing only a trickle of God through. We too often conserve our best energies like residents of a spiritually drought-stricken land who believe that the God reservoir is running perilously low. We can all think of difficult relationships in which we were reluctant to let any more of that life-giving water flow than was absolutely necessary. Some people treat their tears, whether of joy or sorrow, the same way. We can think of what moves us to tears as God trying to flow in us, but we may have learned long ago to shut that flow down. As they begin to cry, many of my patients say, "I was going to try to get through this today without tears." So often it is when patients stop blocking the release of tears that I feel the strongest flow of healing energies in our time together. Just as some of my patients think of God as far away, they often perceive the self-esteem, healing, courage, joy, or acceptance they long for as distant too. But the shadow energies we live with do not seem distant. We know their persistent presence in us all too well. We experience anxiety both in the mind and in the body. The dark thoughts of depression play over and over in the brain. Anger lives in the tone of our voice and the muscle tone of our clenched fists. This familiar inner presence of shadow energies reminds me of that line from the 1979 horror movie When a Stranger Calls. "The call is coming from inside the house." It often seems to us, however, that the higher energies we associate with God need to be called in from or prayed to somewhere outside of us. I like to add a word to the common phrase, "let go, let God," to make it read, "let go, let God flow." I don't want to hand my worries off to a distant deity. I want to let go of whatever in me is impeding the flow of compassion, acceptance, and peace. I want to uncork the courage to make my best response to life, however it has unfolded. Letting God be God in us is not something we can do only when we are sufficiently healed. It is the ultimate path to healing. Every day I try to open. Every day I try to open the spigot of creativity. Every day I try to open the spigot of creativity for God. Every day I try to open the spigot of creativity for God to come gushing out. And this is from Now Is Where God Lives, a year of nested meditations to delight the mind and awaken the soul by Kevin Anderson. We pause for a moment to remind you that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, 24 hours of programming from over 300 publications, and you are currently listening to the Philosopher Program with your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis. You can take Sun Sounds with you. You can get our stream and on demand on our new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. We return now to Mike Dooley's channeled messages from deep space, Wisdom for a Changing World, with Tracy Farquhar, who channels a group called Frank. They've come from another galaxy, another planet, and they've learned how to travel without their bodies or a spaceship, and they come to other planets going through similar things that they did to see if they can provide help. We had started Part 3, The Greater Universe. Mike says, "These questions create the opportunity to learn about broader considerations beyond life on either Bohoshka, their home planet, or Earth, and to learn about universal truths, presumably applying to all forms of life that once known will help us flourish here and now." And we'll start at the beginning again. "Can you explain our relationship with divine mind, God? And can you explain the disconnect we often feel between ourselves and Source?" The divine mind, or source energy, is the basis of all energetic mass in the universe, and it is this energy that connects us to the essence of ourselves. Source energy is not just present when it is called upon. It is the current of force that energizes all matter and all energetic fields within the dimensional realms. Source is what animates us, and it is the originator of all aspects of being. That being said, as energetic emanations of Source, we are inherently connected to this divine energy. And in fact, This energy runs through the very core of all living beings, tying us intrinsically to our origins in a mutually responsive connection that allows Source to experience the incarnated life through the energy of the individual and allows the individual access to the limitless essence of Source. As we are all aspects of this divine mind, we are also intrinsically connected to each other through this non-judgmental and loving energy. This connection is also at the core of our beings, and it is in these moments of divine connection that we experience the greatest sense of wholeness and peace available to an incarnated being. By the same token, we are each individual aspects of this source energy, and as such, we express the different aspects through the individual nature of our personality and varying traits. We are provided with an ego, or a sense of separated selfhood, so that we are best able to exercise our individual free will and choice-making. It is within these acts of manifestation that we are exercising our divine powers of creation. The sense of separation stems from this realization of our own individual nature and from a belief structure that is built upon the idea of judgment, reward, and punishment. Instead of seeing ourselves as divine aspects of source energy, these types of dogma create a sense of obligation to a separate and self-righteous leader who sits in judgment of his lowly offspring. Many are taught to experience themselves as children of a vengeful father who were created merely to please their creator with acts of worship and contrition. It is difficult to feel a sense of connection with an energy that stands ready to punish those who do not please it. Many will lose their sense of divine connection because they feel unable to live up to the standards that are supposedly set by this higher power, and so they will eventually give up and find little pleasure in their lives, seeing themselves as inherently flawed beings who can never please their divine father. Still others will find joy in acts of service to their creator, but will never truly look within at the divinity that exists there. Instead, they will forever look outward to find that sense of connection and most likely will never feel what it is that they wish to feel. Within each of these choices lies a divine experience that offers a different aspect of the evolution of the soul. And so it is important to remember that no choice is a wrong one for the experience of that being in this incarnation. Some may alternately choose such incarnations for the balance of experience known as karma and the richness of living many different types of incarnated lives to further educate and enlighten the soul. And then there will be those who will heed the intuitive calling of the heart and soul that is acutely aware of this direct connection to source energy and who will strive to honor that connection through the honoring of themselves, their lives, and their works. It is a fallacy to believe that Source requires an external sense of worship that involves a diminishing of the individual. Rather, the true worship of Source is experienced through acts of self-love and self-care, expression of the gifts of the soul, and sharing of the inner light of the individual, as these are true expressions of the divine. Source energy is ever flowing and ever moving through the energy of the incarnated being, and it is expressed through the inner senses, the intuition, and the creative expression of the individual. When one falls out of touch with these aspects of oneself, either as a result of social pressures or out of a sense of unreasonable expectations that one places on oneself, emotions become troubled and a sense of despair ensues. In this sense of despair lies loneliness and disconnection, and not only with source energy, but with all other beings. The act of staying connected presents its own challenges, as the brain is wired with many volatile emotional responses to stimuli in the exterior world, and is often ruled by the fears of the ego. It is through the spiritual practices of meditation, peaceful intention, and focus on the divine light within that one is most able to feel that ever-present connection and become aware of the subtle guidance presented by it. It is in those experiences of true connection that one is able to feel the authentic essence and nature of being. It is in the act of co-creation that one is truly expressing the divine light into a dimensional space of reality. Therefore, it is Source that is at the essence of all creation, and as such, all creation is connected as vibrational frequency back to Source. All conscious beings are gifted with the sense of will, which is designed so that they can experience that sense of creation that is at the essence of Source. And we are able to decide what to do with that gift. As the origin and fundamental essence of all things, Source is ever-present and continually involved in the act of manifestation through its own handiwork. We are not only connected to Source, we are Source in all of its infinite forms. There is the question of divine intervention or miracles affected by Source energy outside of the realm of individual expression of creation, and it is true that these do occur. As a function of creation, Source expresses itself through the synchronistic acts that lead to the physical healing, the bringing together of various soul beings, avoidance of disaster, and other miraculous events that cannot be explained by logical means. However, it is important to understand that although it appears as though these miracles are occurring outside of the normal human experience, they are directly connected to the will of the being experiencing them, and as such, they are also co-created by the individual in congruence with Source. We are created as partners, you see, and thus we bear the responsibility to simply use our will and our choices to create the reality we choose to experience. This includes the experiences that may be labeled as miraculous. There are many truths to be found in religion surrounding the nature of God, Source, divine energy, and there are many contrived falsehoods. Some will cling to the falsehoods out of a sense of the comfort that is experienced when one feels that someone else is responsible for their experiences. There is an absolution of responsibility and an adoption of the role of victim to the whims of a loving but vengeful God. One only needs to follow certain rules in order to gain reward, and if one breaks those rules, one can find forgiveness through ritual. This is the construct of religion that was devised to exploit and assert control over the individual will. At the heart of all religions, however, is the sense of a powerful, creative, and loving force that is ever-present and alive in all things. The nature of this energy was once equated to the natural forces, and the energetic essence of God was said to be expressed in all natural aspects of being. The beauty of nature, the changing seasons, the mystery of the universe, all were seen as aspects of this divine presence. This, then, is the true expression of the divine. In the energetic structure of all things, in the spiritual essence of your own being, and in the divine will that is present within you. Mike, you are a collective of eight. Are you as able to connect with us and explore the universe individually, or do you need the collective energy of your group? As a rule, we travel in groups. This is due to many factors. The energy of the collective is far greater than that of one individual, and so we find that our ability to communicate is better and that the energy we spend on the work we do is more evenly distributed. There's much to be said for combining forces toward a common goal, and so we have made it a standard practice to do this work collectively. We also find that there's a sense of safety when traveling and working as a group. For instance, when one of us has an issue with the energetic transference, another is always available to assist, guide, and reassure. The confidence that comes from this knowledge alleviates the fear of traveling alone. Therefore, the experience is much more positive than it might otherwise be. In addition, we find that as a group, we are able to share thoughts, ideas, and suggestions about how best to accomplish what we have set out to do. For example, when we are answering your questions, we will consult among ourselves for the best possible way to respond, and we find that those joint responses are much richer, wiser, and more comprehensive than any one being could offer. While it is absolutely possible for just one of us to project the energy of consciousness through universal time and space, it is not something we would recommend or practice, as we have found that the benefits of the collective eliminate the desire we may have once had for traveling alone. Mike, do you work with other planetary civilizations? We have worked with other civilizations in varying ways. Not all of our work is as intensely focused. Sometimes it is simply to educate them about the vastness of universal energy and to help them place themselves in the grand scheme of the universe and its design. Planting that seed of thought was often enough to create an acceleration of consciousness from which they could experience the richness of their life experience with the intended intensity and use it to its greatest advantage. We will disengage our energy when our intended purpose has been served, or when it is clear that our attempts are being met with too much resistance to be useful. Mike, Did life once exist on Mars or elsewhere in our solar system? If so, are we descendants of such life, as claimed by many theorists? Is our past so straightforward as to always have yes or no answers? Or are there different pasts, as there are different futures? The truth, as you are intuiting here, is not quite so simple and straightforward as some may believe. Even the truth that we are suggesting to you has its flaws in the reality of our multidimensional existence. In this sense of reality, there are no absolutes. And so while there may not be scientific evidence of the evolution of life throughout the universe, it certainly exists, and the theory of multiple pasts that you are referring to here has a certain amount of truth to it. Understand that life has always and will always exist in some form. These life forms may not be what you would now consider to be legitimate expressions of life, and their forms may be so far out of the realm of your understanding of what life is that you would not even comprehend them as an aspect of creation. This limited understanding is by design, as it creates a narrow comprehension of reality, which is necessary for you to focus on the here and now of the life you are currently living. However, we would like to suggest that you consider that there is an infinite number of ways that the universe can be expressed as a form of consciousness, and that Source is present in all of those expressions. As such, there do exist such unexpected life forms, and they are valid and real. And so we would like to suggest to you that all the planets have, at one time, in some dimensional space and in some field of conscious existence, had life of some form on them. And that all of these forms of life, whether they are in your current dimensional expression of time and space or some other, are connected energetically. This is why the sense that you are not alone as a species, or that there are others present in the universe, feels resonant with so many. You intrinsically know that you are connected to much more than what is present in your current field of awareness. And so we would agree with some of the theories to which you refer, but we would also say that they are not the complete truth, and that there are many other theories that contain bits and pieces of truth, as that truth is limited by the deliberately narrow field of belief that is possible in the human brain. This, we understand, is quite the esoteric answer, and not quite as concrete as you may have been hoping for, but we would suggest that you sit with the immense possibility of it and see how it feels, rather than limit it to what you can intellectually understand. Mike, can you explain the angelic realm? How much can they help us? If they help us, does their intervening deny us the opportunity to learn of our own power? The angelic realm consists of higher vibrational beings who have not incarnated into the physical and who have agreed to remain in the non-physical state with the purpose of aiding physical beings on their life paths. Understand that there's a certain amount of pre-planning that occurs when the soul being agrees to incarnate into the physical. It is sometimes the case that the soul being, in its state of freedom from the heavy constraints of a physical life, becomes overzealous in its blueprinting of its life structure. Once they've entered the physical realm, these beings may find that some of the obstacles and challenges inherent in their path become a bit too much for them to handle. There may be moments of despair and grief, sadness and frustration, loneliness and emptiness, which can become overwhelming for those who are not able to see the higher purpose of their existence. It is in these moments that these higher beings may be called into assistance. The high vibration of these beings can influence those in the physical realm in a number of ways. It can lend comfort in moments of despair. It can cause slight alterations in the physical path, which may alleviate some suffering. It can accelerate the raising of consciousness and assist those on a spiritual path in understanding their own divinity. In this way, these beings are seen as partners or mentors to those they assist, and their actions are not seen as interference with the choices of physical beings. Again, this assistance is agreed upon in advance, and so an angelic being will not intervene without some type of request, either from the consciousness of the being or from the calling of the soul. As with all energetic beings, the angelic realm is an extension of source energy, and as such, it is in service to all beings with love and compassionate guidance. The physical being is free to experience free will in response to this intervention. It can be seen as a gift from Source and confirmation of the higher realms, or it can be seen as simple coincidence or luck. Whatever choice is made will once again have an effect on the trajectory of that being's particular life path, and no choice is a wrong one. There are many angelic beings available to you at any given moment, and within those beings are infinite aspects of themselves, which means they are available in an unlimited way. The calling in of an angel does not diminish their ability to assist others, and that call will always be heeded and answered, even when you feel it is being ignored. There are those whose responses are quiet and subtle, and those whose energy is felt by the physical being as a palpable, physically manifested shift in their material environment. These aspects of being are deliberate and will be in resonance with the life path of the individual. There are many levels of non-physical beings that serve different purposes and fulfill different roles. The angelic realm encompasses a vast array of beings whose work is all equally important, but there are those with the highest frequency and closest aspect to Source whose energy and awareness can be felt by those with certain sensitivities. These beings are what you refer to as the archangels, and while many of the ideas about these beings in your teachings are correct, there are also some misconceptions about them that are simply human constructs and have no basis in the truth. For instance, in your artwork and visual depictions of angels, they are most often shown with wings. This depiction occurred because the human was not able to understand how a being could move through time and space in an unlimited way without some physical assistance to transport them. The magical element of flying created an otherworldly aspect of these beings and explained how they could cover great distances unhindered by the limited physical body. In actuality, these beings do not require wings, as they are non-physical beings who are not limited by time and space. However, if they choose to create a visual image of themselves to those they are serving, they may choose to present themselves in this traditional way so that the nature of their being is made clear to the person who is observing them. The intervention of the angelic realm will always be done with the highest intention to assist the physical being with some aspect of their path, which has become out of control or overwhelming. And so it is within those moments of assistance that the physical being is able to be enriched on their path, rather than having their own power of manifestation taken away. The angelic realm answers calls for assistance. And so their assistance will come only as a last resort, when all else has failed and it is clear that some help is required. It is important for you to understand that none of you is traveling this physical path alone, no matter what is reflected to you by your outside world. There are always angelic beings, guides, loved ones in spirit, and other beings whose purpose is to assist and uplift you as you travel the sometimes challenging road of your life. Mike, can you explain how numerology works, if it does in fact work? We would like to begin by pointing out that all life consists of the structure of patterns. From the atomic level to the cellular level, there are patterns that create a grid of energy needed to support a system. Consider the natural world around you and how it consists of a series of patterns, grids, and structural repetitions that support mass, weight, and depth. This is true of all energy and matter in the universe. Even energy that appears to be chaotic supports some type of pattern within it. The minds of mathematicians, artists, musicians, physicists, and accountants alike are well aware of how patterns create systems, and systems create order. The numerical patterns that are tapped into when studying the field of numerology capitalize on these patterns and structures, and within those patterns are found repeating energetic forces that influence the energetic structure of the energy of the human being, thereby affecting personality, emotions, and tendencies. As such, all aspects of your identity contain within them certain patterns that can be used to reflect aspects of your character. And since all aspects of your being are integrated into your identity, your birth date, name, astrological arrangement, birthplace, ancestry, genetic composition, and more, each aspect can be examined to uncover certain patterns that affect your personality. Numerology is just one of these types of patterns, and it can be quite the revealing study. Mike, What about tarot cards? How can they be read when they seem purely random? There are many tools that can be utilized to assist in the focus needed to tap into the higher senses of intuition and so-called psychic abilities. As sentient beings in an existence that is full of distractions and material concerns, the higher senses are often negated in favor of the intellect and logic. These tools create a point of focus that is needed to tune out the distractions of the material world and bring the energy into the higher senses, which is where the connection to truth and source energy is accessible. The system of the tarot allows an activation of the intuitive senses, both in the drawing of seemingly random cards and the interpretation of the same. As there is intention in the action of drawing and reading the cards, there's nothing about that action that is truly random, as intention is the driving force behind all actions and their results. Tapping into the higher intuitive energy allows access to higher wisdom and knowledge, and as representatives of certain aspects of the life path, the tarot cards can help place focus on those areas that need attention in the life of the card reader subject. As with the patterns of numerology, astrology, genealogy, and other influential aspects of energetic existence, the tarot allows for deeper understanding and wisdom to emerge that is not accessible through the confines of intellectual thought. And as with all excavations into the richness of the incarnated experience, it is the intention that is the driving force, no matter what method or tool is used. Mike, do souls have different ages? Are there incarnational archetypes, such as those taught by author Chelsea Quinn Yarbrough? Server, priest, artisan, sage, warrior, king, and scholar? If possible, can you speak to the relevance of both soul ages and archetypes? The idea of a soul age is based on the premise that there's a linear progression from infancy to maturity in the soul, as there is in the physical lifetime of an individual. While it is true that the soul is enhanced and evolves through the experiences in the physical realm, and therefore will experience a certain type of maturation as it accumulates these experiences, there is not exactly an infancy stage of the soul as is described in this work. The soul is formed as an extension of source energy, and as such, it is whole and complete at its inception. There is some truth, however, in the notion that souls who have not experienced many incarnations in the physical realm will have different challenges than those who have experienced many physical lifetimes. The process is not quite as pronounced as it is in the lifetime of a physical entity, which begins with a sense of helplessness and dependency at its inception, passes through a maturation process through learning and exploration, and ends in a state of mental and spiritual maturity. The soul does not only experience its growth and evolution in the physical. There's much to be learned and experienced in the non-physical, and so an aspect of the soul that chooses to incarnate in the physical is not quite as immature and devoid of experience as this notion may suggest. The truth in this theory surrounds the idea that those with limited physical experience will tend to choose experiences that are rooted in the physical. They may have more issues with the physical body, material possessions, and security. This is because their initial experiences will be all about living life in the physical realm. And so this foundational experience will be what sets the tone for any subsequent incarnations that this soul aspect may choose. This does not mean, however, that these newer souls will choose the most challenging aspects of a physical existence. In fact, they will most likely choose fewer and less severe challenges as they discover how much they're able to withstand. It is the most evolved and experienced soul who chooses the most severe challenges in the physical life, such as chronic illness, physical, mental, and psychological challenges, and severe struggles with poverty, abuse, or other types of suffering. Only those who feel they're ready to take on these types of challenges will incarnate with this kind of life framework. Again, this does not mean that the aspect of the soul that chooses an experience in the physical is in any way flawed or lacking. It means that the soul being chooses these experiences to enhance its potential and enrich its broad spectrum of experience. No soul being is created as lacking. It is whole and complete at its inception, but with plenty of room to grow and learn in every possible way. More evolved souls may also choose a life of spiritual inquiry and exploration, as their exploration of life through the physical experiences has already enriched them, and they are aware that it's time to explore the higher realms from the perspective of the physical form. Be aware that in the non-physical state of being, learning occurs at an accelerated pace, and the experience is not limited by time and space. Applying the linear constraints of time to the evolution of the soul is placing limits on an unlimited experience for the sake of creating understanding. And so, while there is truth in various forms in this work, these truths are being explained and translated through the linear construct of the brain of the human who is channeling them. This, by the way, also occurs in the work we are doing with this channel. Since we are aware of it, we are usually able to compensate for it. The archetypes of experience are symbolic references to the types of life journeys chosen by the aspect of the soul as it maps out its physical path. These seven archetypes contain within the many different life experiences, and so there's much truth to the notion that the symbolic aspects of those roles will be the guiding factor in the manifestation of the foundational life structure. To limit these to seven, however, is not quite accurate. So once again, while there is truth to the idea of archetypes or symbols of the physical life experience, these symbols are not fully represented here. It can also be said that every incarnation will have aspects of all of these archetypes to some degree, but that some may be more dominant than others. As the soul evolves and makes choices about its life path on its journeys in the physical, these archetypes may change. It is built into the structure of the life path that the individual can alter its course and choose other types of experience as it goes along. And so the aspect of the soul that chooses to incarnate may decide originally on the experience of a server, but at some point in that role may decide to evolve out of it and into one of the other roles for the betterment of the experience. This is the aspect of divine will, which is taken into account at the time of designing the physical experience as such. The soul aspect does not place too much expectation on the path its incarnated expression may choose. As with most human theories about the spiritual world and the soul's journey, there are limitations, misinterpretations, and oversimplified categorizations that simply do not exist outside of the confines of the human brain. So we would like to suggest that you view our answers as a foundational structure of truth that can be expanded upon and explored more and more deeply to find the ultimate truth, but also understand that some aspects of non-physical existence are simply not comprehensible by the physical matter of the brain. We come now to the end of our program. As always, I wish you a beautiful, joyous, and wonderful new week, and I look forward to being with you next time on our Philosopher program.